Wind Rider's Claws, February 1904 to May 1905. Later, at the company, Uncle sat for a long time figuring things on his abacus. The beads clacked as his fingers flew back and forth. Through the ceiling, we could hear Black Dog snoring upstairs.
"The money can be made up out of my share," Uncle said. "Don't be an old fool," Father said. "There's not just the matter of the woman to be made up. There's the justices to be paid off." "No. Whiskey Devil, he's the head of the justices, owes me a favor from a long time ago. It won't cost that much."
"Still," White Deer said, "it ought to come out of all our shares. We can write it up to expenses."
"He's my son," Uncle said sternly. "I'm responsible for him."
"Money, money, money," Handclap said disgustedly. "Who cares about the money or where it comes from? The point is that any one of us could be a dopey and sleeping upstairs."
Lefty massaged his right arm.
"Handclap is right, and it would not have to be just dope. It could be gambling for me, or any one of a thousand different traps that a Tong man could fall into in this demon's land."
"Put it to a vote," White Deer said. "All those in favor of sharing the cost, put up your hands."
He and Handclap put up their hands.
"You're both fools," Uncle began. "Think of your families."
"They do, old man," Father said. "That's why they're here. But this is their family, too. Now will you get talking to your justices?"
Uncle slammed his abacus down on the table.
"Who could talk to fools?"
He grumbled, but there was a pleased look in his eye. As soon as Black Dog had recovered, he promised to reform. He sounded as if he meant it, but then he always did, Handclap told me later. Black Dog kept his promise for a time. Pale and shaky, he moved about the laundry working as hard as any of us, but after a while he began to get snappish again and to sneer at things. It was his way. I think he had lived so long in this land of the demons that his mind had become poisoned, and he had begun to think like a demon and to despise the Tong people around him. Maybe when he had first begun to take dope, he had just meant to get away from his conflicts, but after a while, taking dope had become an end in itself. Now, quite a few of the older Tong people used opium. Everybody, including Father, would have an occasional pellet, but that was the way they might have a drink or gamble at the tables. But there were certain individuals who had gone over the edge, who knew no moderation. Opium for Black Dog was what gambling had been for Lefty, but Lefty had stopped, more or less, at least compared to his old days. Black Dog's real problem was his inability to control himself. Finally, one month after we had brought him back, he disappeared. And on the next day, when he came back, we smelled opium's strange, sweet smell, like roasted peanuts, clinging to Black Dog's clothes, and we knew where he had been. When I had been in the demon's country for over 2 years, Uncle sent me to make the rounds among some of our regular customers in the Tong people's town to collect overdue bills. As he said, even by demon reckoning, it took two figures to write my age, for I was 11 by our system of counting, and 10 by theirs. I had been collecting money for a month when I saw Black Dog lounging in a doorway, staring at the May rain.
"What are you doing here?" I asked.
"I had to take a walk and get some fresh air."
He stared up at the sky with a frown and pulled his collar up about his neck. The rain ran down the brim of his hat, splattering on his shoulders.
"But it's a miserable day."
"I guess," I said. I had the small canvas bag of money under my loose shirt. "Going back to the company?"
"Why not?"
Black Dog shrugged. He fell into a step beside me, and we walked up the hill in silence. Black Dog folded his arms across his chest, almost hugging himself.
Don't you hate it here?"
"I don't like it, if that's what you mean. But White Deer says that hate is so strong a word that I ought to use it only for evil."
"But there's another way to forget evil," Black Dog said.
We stopped for a moment in a doorway when the rain fell harder.
"Did you ever hear about how we got opium?"
he asked finally. The British demons forced us to let them sell it in the Middle Kingdom, I said.
Ah, that's what some people say who want to hide the truth, because they don't want to give the poor man his due. He was a poor working man, like you or me, who, no matter how hard he worked, always wound up owing more and more to the bosses. The only thing he owned outright was his ugly wife, maybe the ugliest woman alive. She was so repulsive that he beat her in the morning when he got up, and he beat her in the evening when he came home. The wife never complained, because she loved him dearly. But finally, when she saw how much he hated her, she fell ill because she was so sad. On her deathbed, she called her husband to her and told him that after her death, he would realize how much she loved him despite everything he had done to her. At once, the poor farmer felt sorry for what he had done, but before he could tell her, she died. 10 days later, the poor farmer noticed a strange white flower growing from her grave. There was a little round fruit inside the flower. At first, the poor farmer was afraid that his wife had turned into some poisonous flower. He could not sleep at night, thinking about the flower and what he had done to his wife. He could not work during the day, remembering the blows he had given her. "She has every right to hurt me," the poor farmer said, "for I've been a mean, spiteful man." With that, he fell sick himself. But he had no money to pay the doctors, nor any offspring to care for him. And then one night, during a feverish dream, he saw his wife. She told him that the flower on her grave had been woven from the strands of her soul. The strange fruit in the flower could heal him. He was to cut the fruit and harden the juice that would come out and smoke it. If he smoked it every day, he would become healthy. The very next morning he got up and did as his wife had told him, and no sooner did he take his first puff than he felt his illness leave him. So it was that he and his wife were closer in death than they were in life. Black Dog smiled ironically. "So it is to those two lovers that I smoke, for the name of the ugly wife was Life, and the name of the farmer was Everyman. The only good thing I ever got out of my ugly life was the flower."
I did not understand his story at all. "But life isn't all ugly," I said.
"Don't you think it's ugly here? What kind of lives do we lead without wives and families?"
"There's no money back at home."
"But why sacrifice yourself just so others can get fat at home? All they ever understand is that they need more money.
Things will be better in the next life. Maybe we'll be born as the sons of noble families. Maybe we'll even finally find release from this world." Black Dog looked at me intently.
"Why shouldn't we get pleasure in this life? Why later? Why not now?"
"Because we don't owe things just to ourselves. There are others." He grabbed me by the arm, and his voice grew wild.
"Don't give me your simpering, mealy-mouthed answers. We've repaid our debts a dozen times over."
"You're hurting me," I said. All the time, in my mind, I was telling myself that I must not be frightened. I must not be frightened.
"You don't know what pain is," Black Dog said. "Wait till you have been here for 30 years. Then you'll welcome the pain. They were once as pleasant to me as they are to you."
He twisted my arm. I let out a yell. I kicked him hard in the knee, and he let go of me with a grunt. I began to run up the hill. My hat flew off. I kept on running. I heard his boots come closer as he followed me. Suddenly, I felt a pain in the back of my head. He had grabbed my cue. I stopped short as he jerked at the cue and fell on my back. He tore the money bag away from me, but he did not even look at it.
"Pain," he said strangely. "Pain. You don't know what it is."
And he began to kick me with his heavy boots. When I came to, I was back in the company. Father was pressing a wet towel against my forehead anxiously.
"He's awake,"
he said. The rest of the company crowded around me.
"What beast did this to you, boy?"
Lefty asked. I found that I was not even mad at Black Dog. How could you be mad at some dumb, pain-goaded animal? I did not know what to do or say. The company looked so stern and solemn. But Uncle took it out of my hands.
"Was it Black Dog?"
he demanded. I did not say anything.
"Was it?"
Uncle asked. "Yes," I said reluctantly.
"I'll cut off his head and throw it into the gutter where the dogs can eat it," Uncle said.
"How can you curse your own son that way?"
White Deer scolded him.
"He's no son of mine," Uncle declared.
Father turned heavily in his seat.
"That's good to know. Then you'll let me take care of him." "I should have let you, or any one of a dozen men, take care of him a long time ago. He's not a man. He's an animal," Uncle said.
"You won't do any such thing, Wind Rider,"
White Deer said.
"Black Dog is a member of the company."
"Kick him out," Uncle said.
"We'll put it to a vote," White Deer said. "I say bring him to the police and let them handle it."
"Bring him to the demon police?"
Uncle asked.
"Yes, the demon police,"
Lefty said. Handclap nodded.
"Otherwise," White Deer reasoned, "you'll have to take it up with the sleepers. They're not about to let anyone go around beating up one of their brothers without their permission, no matter what he's done."
"The justices were going to shoot Black Dog," Father pointed out.
"They asked the sleepers. You ought to know that,"
Lefty said.
"And the sleepers only gave their permission because they didn't want a war with the justices."
"I'll go to the sleepers myself," Uncle said grimly. "They won't refuse me permission." "No."
Father let out his breath in a rush.
"No. I'm sick of having to deal with thieves and pimps and pushers. I'm sick of having to scrape and bow to men who live off the misery of their brothers and sisters."
"Now, now,"
White Deer soothed.
"There are many good men in the Brotherhoods who earn their money as we do and who don't deal with those things. It's only a small number who are criminals."
But Father whirled around to face White Deer.
"Don't you see? We're all tainted by it. As long as we keep quiet and let it go on, we're as bad as they are. It eats at them. It eats at us."
The others were silent. Father might have slapped each one of them in the face. He should have kept his mouth shut then, but the dragonness in him would not let him. He had to speak his mind.
"We mustn't play their games anymore by their rules." "They are our brothers," Uncle said, "no matter how bad. That's why we don't go to the demon police. We Tong people take care of our own affairs. It's better that way. Remember the virtues of the stranger, the lonely man in foreign lands. Be silent. Be cunning. Be invisible. Besides, what's the use of going to the demons? The sleepers can afford to pay more bribes to the police than we can. The demons will just listen to our complaint and then file it away. Better to go to the sleepers themselves." "If you won't go to the demons, there's only one other way to make sure that justice is done," Father said. "And that's to do it myself."
There was something about his posture and the look of his eye that reminded me of dragons. All the others in the room could feel it too. Then I realized that to be a dragon meant more than just taking an interest in the magic of machines. It was also to live by the spirit of dragons, and Father felt that no dragon would let such an act go unpunished.
"Dragons," Father went on, "protect their own brood." "Dragons, dragons, dragons, always that nonsense," Uncle said impatiently.
I think he instantly regretted his words, for Father's mouth hardened at that. Father sat back in his chair. It creaked under the shift of weight.
"When I was there on the beach and in the Dragon Kingdom, it was more real a time than this." "Don't kill yourself for a foolish dream," Uncle insisted.
He would not have said such cruel things normally, but he was worried about Father.
And besides, you promised.
He glanced at me and was quiet. What promise? I asked. It was a long time before Father spoke. He folded his hands and looked at them while he talked.
You do many strange things when you're young. And maybe the strangest thing you do is join a secret society that says it's dedicated to throwing out the Manchus. You enlist, you act as a soldier for the future of the Middle Kingdom. And then you realize that though they make a lot of patriotic speeches, at heart they're only criminals.
And did you do that?
I once was a sleeper, Father said.
The others left our room shortly after that. But we no sooner had turned off the gaslight and lain down than we heard a bump at the door. Father got up and opened it to see Lefty sitting in the hallway facing our door. The hallway was so narrow that though Lefty had his back against the wall, he had to draw his knees up toward his chest. By his left side, he had a club. He smiled apologetically.
Excuse me, Windrider. I meant to be quiet. Handclap should never have eaten so much squash. That one has so much gas that I cannot stand sleeping in the same room with him, so I have come out here for cleaner air.
Right by my door.
The air is cleaner here.
Father slammed the door shut. Why should the air be cleaner here? I asked him.
Be quiet,
Father snapped.
The fools are trying to keep me in.
We had no window in our room, so the only way out was through the door. Father paced around the room. Finally, he seemed to notice me again.
Go to sleep, Shadow.
How do you expect to be reborn again as a dragon if you act like a criminal? I asked him.
Dragons have claws, too.
Father pushed me down on the mat and drew the quilt up about my neck.
Now go to sleep.
I felt rather than heard Father stir. He lit the gaslight, keeping it dim. Half awake, I watched as he rolled off his mat and got dressed, except for his boots. Then he went to our trunk and eased the lid up, piling the things silently on the floor until he reached the very bottom. From this, he drew a flat rectangular package, and he undid the plain cotton cloth about it. The demons called it a hatchet, but it was really a squarish sword, looking much like a cleaver, except that the balance was truer. The light gleamed on the blade. He set it down by the door. Then he found his boots and set them down by his sword. He put his hand on the doorknob and leaned his ear against the door as if listening to Lefty in the hallway. Father straightened and wriggled his shoulders as if to relax them. He took several deep breaths before he jerked the door open. I had never seen Father move so fast. He jerked the door open, and Lefty had time to stare up in disbelief as he groped for his club when Father's fist hit him in the jaw. Lefty's head tilted back sharply, and he had a glassy look in his eyes. As he began to slump over, Father caught him and eased him to the floor. I closed my eyes quickly when Father came back into our room. I raised my eyelids slightly so I could watch Father pick up his hat, boots, and sword in one hand before he closed the door. I remembered again that Mother had told me to look after Father. I scrambled for my things, and with my boots clutched against my chest, I padded after him. I was just in time to see him pull on his boots before he went outside. I counted to 10 before I followed him outside. It was a night when the thick fog drifted through the streets, and I could not see more than an arm's length before me, and everything seemed unreal, as if I were asleep and dreaming. The gaslights showed in the fog only as dull spots of light, like ghosts hovering. A building would appear out of the grayness and then disappear. The whole world seemed to have become unglued. If ever there was a night for monsters to be out, this was the night. I could hear Father's steady, determined footsteps fading away into the distance. I decided not to put my boots on after all because the echoes might tell Father I was behind him. I shivered as I walked on the cold, wet pavement. I picked my way through the garbage and over the occasional demon who lay sprawled on the street with the vacant look of a dopey. We went 2 blocks down DuPont Street, and then 1 block up the steep street of the Tang people into an alley. I crept down the alley until I dimly saw Father's tall figure bulk out of the mist. He knocked at a door. I ducked into a nearby doorway.
Who is it?
a voice asked.
It's the Wind Rider. I want to see the Water Fairy.
Who?
Some call him the Tiger General now.
The little door shut, and Father stood unmoving there in the cold, his collar turned up, his sword in one hand. I stood shivering, my boots clutched to my chest, afraid to go to him, but afraid to leave. I knew that the Tiger General was the head of the Brotherhood, but how he had gotten that other name, as improbable as it sounded, I did not know. Finally the door opened, and I saw a small, wizened man.
It's been a long time since anyone used that name.
My uncle has a long memory, reaching back to the railroad camps, and a young man who drank the water as the demons did without boiling it first. He told all the other Tong people what a superior stomach he had. He took sick with the cramps and the runs.
That name is the only thing that saved you from being shot down on our doorstep. I wanted to see what fool would dare use it. I should have known it would be you.
All that's past. Send my kinsman out to me.
But the Tiger General stayed where he was.
It's in my mind that you and Black Dog may have been mortal enemies in some former lives and done great harm to one another. You never did get along from the day you joined us to the day you quit.
Think what you like, Father shrugged. But I beg you to keep this matter between the two of us.
While the two talked, I had watched a shadow creep out of the narrow alley between the sleeper's hall and the building I was in. The shadow ducked back into the alley mouth. In his hand was a heavy pistol.
He beat up my son for the money he had collected, Father said. Do you protect child beaters and thieves?
The Tiger General considered that for a moment and then turned in the doorway.
Tell our brother he has a caller.
There was a scuffling from within. Then the Tiger General stepped aside as Black Dog was pushed, stumbling, out into the street. He paused for a moment on all fours. His shirt was rumpled as if he had been dragged to the door. He stood up and smoothed out his shirt.
I'm sick. A dopey is always sick, he said to Father.
You weren't too sick to beat up my boy. Now fight, Father said.
But you're armed, and as you can see.
Black Dog held up his empty hands. One of his brothers tossed a sword out onto the cobblestones. Black Dog turned to look with astonishment at the others. The Tiger General merely folded his hands behind his back. Reluctantly, Black Dog bent slowly, as if his back hurt.
Now!
He shouted and straightened up quickly, raising the sword over his head to throw it.
The man in the alley stepped out, cocking his pistol. He began to aim at Father. I threw myself against the man, literally threw my whole body, as if I were only an object against him. I hit him in the stomach, and he collapsed with a grunt. To my astonishment, I found I still held my boots. I began to use the heavy-soled boots like clubs, flailing at the man. Black Dog cut viciously at Father's head, but Father had accurately judged the length of Black Dog's swing and kept his head just an inch out of the reach of the sword, using his own body to draw Black Dog's swings. It was as if Father were playing with him. Panting, Black Dog cut again and again at Father's head, but he always just missed. Panicked, Black Dog tried one huge, powerful cut and missed. He missed on his back swing, too. Then Father had cut Black Dog across the chest, laying open the shirt. Black Dog stumbled and fell back with a shout. An arm caught me across the chest, and I was tossed off by the man. My head hit the cobblestones hard, and I lay there, looking up breathlessly at a man in his 40s. In his hand was the pistol, and it was aimed at me. Then suddenly the man jerked his head back, and he twitched. There was the sound of a meaty smack, and he fell face forward across my legs. Father's sword in his back. Father picked up the man's pistol and whirled. The Tiger General and some of the brothers had stepped onto the sidewalk. The Tiger General held up his hands apologetically.
It was supposed to be between just you and Black Dog.
And now?
The Tiger General prodded the dead man in the leg.
It is still between you and Black Dog for all we care.
He turned to one of the brothers.
Bind up Black Dog's wound and gather his things. He is no longer a member of this brotherhood. I have had enough of his disobedience. He's already been warned of the penalty.
The Tiger General turned back to us.
Are you satisfied?
Is he?
Father jerked his head in Black Dog's direction.
I cannot say.
The Tiger General shrugged.
But now, when you settle this matter later, it will be strictly a private affair.
I slid out from underneath the dead man, staring at his blood that had spattered my pants leg. Father jerked his sword free from the man's back and wiped the blade carefully on the shirt of the dead man.
Put your boots on, Moonshadow.
Father stood up and turned back again to the Tiger General.
The company wasn't responsible. I acted on my own.
The Tiger General crossed his arms across his chest.
You'd best get out of our town for a while. Not that I care for the likes of those two pigs, but there are some brothers who would resent the death of a brother, no matter what kind of a fool he was.
I understand,
Father said. Father put me to bed and then began to write a letter. I was so sleepy that I fell asleep before I could ask him why he was writing it then. The next morning, Father left early while I was still asleep. When I woke up, nobody knew where he had gone. He did not come back until around noon, when he walked solemnly over to Uncle.
I have already written my wife and mother, telling them about the trouble last night. I have told them we have to leave the Tong people's town.
Uncle put down the pair of trousers he had been washing. The steam in the laundry had slicked his hair down against his face.
Where will you go?
Out there among the demons, Father said.
Don't be a fool. There is nothing that money can't fix, even the killing of a brother,
Uncle snapped.
What can you do out there?
I went to see a demon, Mr. Alger, who manages apartment houses. I have a job, cleaning and fixing things in those houses. I can heal sick machines on the side, too.
And where will you live, then? Uncle demanded. What demon would rent to you?
There is one demoness. She was once rich, but now she's poor. She lets people live in her house for money. They have a stable that they converted into a little room. I'll stay there with my boy.
You can speak their tongue well enough to collect bills, but not well enough to live among them.
I can speak the language of machines, Father said. That will get us by.
To hear you talk, you'd think it was you who'd been knocked on the head instead of your boy.
Maybe I have been, Father said. I feel like I've just woken from some long dream. I can follow the dragon's ways better among the demons than among the Tong people.
That's the real reason, Uncle snapped. But don't you understand me? It's dangerous out there for a Tong man. Just the other day, some demon boys caught Melonhead in the street. Now he's blind in one eye. And that was just traveling from the ferry into the Tong people's town. He wasn't even trying to live among them.
We won't ever have to travel very far away from our home. We ought to be safe.
Uncle waved his hand.
Then go, and good riddance to a fool.
He was hurt and angry and afraid for us all at the same time. I don't think he could really understand why any Tong people would want to leave the safety of our town to live among the demons. I suppose it would have been possible to go living near the sleepers, but it would have meant paying an expensive compensation to them, money Father did not want to pay. And then, too, I think he truly believed that he could follow the dragonness within him better among the demons. The fact that he was willing to live among the demons was a measure of how strongly he believed. Despite Father's words, he seemed as sad as I was the next day when we left the company. He had gone in the morning to clean up our new home. When he came back in the afternoon, we got ready to go. Uncle stayed upstairs in his room while we loaded our possessions into the company's delivery wagon. And then, when the very last box of wires and parts and tools had been loaded into the wagon, Father went up for one last visit to our room. I had stayed downstairs out of courtesy to him. Then the company gathered around us when Father came back down. There were presents, of course. White Deer gave us a little statue of the Buddha to be, a happy, laughing god who would exist in the future when all mankind had been liberated from the material world.
Lefty gave us his magnificently written poem, which he could never reduplicate because he had lost his hand. Handclap gave each of us a little charm on a necklace. On the charm was inscribed the name of the Demon Stomper, who was most often portrayed as a man in a tattered robe, sticking a knife into one eye of a demon while he pulled out the other. It had been blessed by priests back home, the Enlighteners they were called, because their monastery was the place of full enlightenment. Everyone was impressed by Handclap's gift. And then we heard the sound of a door slamming upstairs and footsteps. Uncle had on his best outfit, looking as splendid as any lord. His arms were folded across his stomach, and his hands were hidden in the great sleeves. He hid his affection behind his gruffness.
"Well, you young fool, are you finally finished making enough racket to tear down the house?"
"Yes, Uncle," Father said quietly. Suddenly, Uncle took a porcelain cup from his sleeve. There was a little bit of dark soil in it. In his other hand, he held some incense sticks.
"Here," he said.
There is no way of identifying dirt, of course, but we all knew it must come from Uncle's own little cup of soil that he had brought back after one of his trips to home. For Uncle, the soil was very special, being a bit of the Middle Kingdom and home and more, part of the land which his fathers and their fathers had worked before him.
"Put it in front of all your gods and your demon toys and burn some incense in it."
Father cleared his throat.
"Thank you." "Here, here," Uncle said in an annoyed voice.
He thrust the cup and incense sticks into my hands. His own hands disappeared inside his sleeves again,
and good riddance to you.
He would have turned away, but Father, on impulse, suddenly stuck out his hand. Uncle stared at it for a moment, and then, like a demon, took it and shook hands with Father. Then Father shook hands like a demon with all the others. Rather than bowing and saying goodbye, he was determined to begin doing things in the demonic fashion. We mounted the buckboard next to Handclap. I sat between him and Father. Then Father cracked the reins on the backside of Red Rabbit, and with a lurch the wagon set off. I held the cup in my hands, looking at the familiar buildings passing by. Oh, I would be back to shop for things. Father thought it more prudent if I did the shopping in the Tong people's town for a while, but it would not be the same. Most of my day would be spent away from here. I felt Father's hand on my shoulder. He nodded at the cup.
"We'll give that a special place," he said kindly.